You're listening to Evenings with Sarah McDonald.
Interesting, the psychology of compliments, because sometimes we're reticent to give them and then embarrassed when we get them.
I was reading this piece. It's a piece by a guy called David Robson, which is BBC Online. You can look it up, and it's all about compliments. And he delved into the history of the psychology of giving compliments and receiving compliments. And then he framed it around some of the sort of recent research. And it's absolutely fascinating. And I think, I don't know, I'm like, without being that sort of Pollyanna-ish kind of just, wow, everything's great kind of what I heard someone the other day called toxic positivity, I am finding myself at the moment looking for stories like this to try and find, you know, better aspects of human nature as opposed to the ones that we're seeing that are the sort of poorer aspects. So, and this one really stuck out at me. It's a really interesting look at human psychology.
Mm. Exactly. Well, so what did they do and how did they have a look at this?
So there's a bunch of different studies, and it stems from a study 10 or 11 years ago by Naomi Grant, who's over in Calgary at Mount Royal University. And she did a study where she looked at asking participants to fill out a questionnaire, fairly dull questionnaire, but she had someone come into the room. You know, it's one of those classic university psychology experiments, had an actor come into the room while people were doing the questionnaire, posing to be a psych student, striking up a conversation and just casually complimenting people about the clothes they were wearing. And then as the conversation went on, the actor then mentioned, oh, look, I'm handing out flyers about this careers event. Would you mind handing out some flyers for me and hand them around? And what she found was really striking. So 80% of the participants who offered to help with event publicity had received a compliment, and only 40-something percent of the participants who didn't receive a compliment offered to help. So basically, just the simple act of offering a compliment to someone made them more likely to reciprocate that kindness in some way. Mm. So no real mention of how it was working or what was going on there. And so this follows on then a whole bunch of studies by Naomi Grant and a bunch of other people looking at where that sense comes from and how it works, and it's absolutely fascinating.
So I suppose it's about an exchange of empathy that is a driver for human behavior, or if people feel better about themselves, then they're more likely to be empathetic and helpful to others.
Yeah, it seems to what it seems to come from is a sense of reciprocity. There's different ways of testing this, but in general, the more that you believe that sort of one good turn deserves another, that kind of old-fashioned axiom, the more likely you are to respond to a compliment by doing something helpful for the person who offered the compliment. So it's more, it looks at compliment giving more as a transaction as opposed to just a simple, you know, act of goodwill or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's since gone down into looking at how it works in workplaces, for example, and how things like positive feedback in the workplace can be such a useful thing. So there's, you know, people have been comparing the effect of verbal praise as opposed to giving someone a cash bonus, for example, or a meal voucher or something like that, and looking at the effects of performance and productivity over that sort of thing. And so, and what they found is that in fact, the non-monetary bonuses, that, you know, giving somebody positive feedback or telling them they're doing a good job is actually slightly more effective than just giving someone a cash bonus.
Yeah.
It means that they're going to do better at their job.
Always start with the good news when you're giving someone feedback in the workplace, right? That's just something that at least we've learned over the years.
The really interesting new bit of this research is that people who are giving the compliments now, it turns out, have significantly been underestimating how happy the other person will be to hear the praise they're giving out.
Never underestimate
and sort of,
it.
That's right. And they've been overestimating how cringeworthy they think it would find. Yeah. So they've started to look at the people who are giving the compliments and what things are driving their ability to do that. And so people are sort of consistently underestimating how powerful the effect of a compliment can be. And it's an absolutely fascinating look at the way human behavior is kind of working to drive our interactions with each other.
I suppose you also don't want it to look transactional. You don't want to look like you're doing it just to be a bit of a crawler, which I suppose a lot of Australians worry about, right? And looking uncool and looking like you're trying too hard and you're trying to get something out of it.
bingo. And that's a really, like in Australian culture especially, that's a really important thing, right? It's less so in other cultures that I've lived in and interacted with. And one of the scientists who's been working on this has really emphasises the importance of context around this sort of question. So they're saying, you know, you shouldn't be talking about someone's appearance if you risk objectifying them, for example. So that would not really be an appropriate way to offer a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
So they're suggesting that the way to do this effectively is to stick to things that convey social value, you know, to praise somebody's ability to give a good presentation or to praise the way somebody's handled a difficult situation with somebody. So to put it in that context rather than a simple, do you look good today or whatever. And that's a more efficient way. What it shows, all this research coming together, is that it's a really powerful way to make both the person giving the compliment feel good and the person receiving the compliment.
Right. Well, we're just talking about people watching cartoons to feel good. And then, you know, the big feel-good show at the moment with a lot of compliments in it is Ted Lasso. Have you watched that?
I haven't, no.
Okay, you need to watch that, Darren. That will cheer you up. He is just a ball of positive energy, and you would think it'd be too much and it would be annoying, but it's just wonderful.
It's okay.
Yeah, and his catchphrase is, I appreciate you, I appreciate you, and you think, really? He can get away with it. So watch Ted Lasso, I swear.
Okay, I'm still on the Looney Tunes as far as cartoons go.
Well, fair enough. Looney Tunes. Whatever you need.
Coyote is my favourite.
Yeah. Now, it was Father's Day yesterday, and I love this story you've got about the power of a mother's voice for premature babies.
This is an important study, and you know, something like 15 million babies are born prematurely globally every year, and something like a million of those don't survive. So it's a big issue. It's something that affects lots and lots of families. And one of the issues around premature babies is that in order to keep them alive, they get put into these neonatal intensive care units, or NICUs, you might have heard them called. And these young bubs are often subject to a lot of clinical procedures. You know, their lungs haven't developed properly, their eyes haven't developed properly. They're undergoing a lot of interventions in that clinical context, and they're doing it usually separated from their parents, both by touch and by sound. You know, they're in these little incubator cribs. There's lots of beeping noises around. So it's a very stressful environment for the kids.
Mm.
And we know that not just the medical or the fact that they're born preterm can provide a lot of developmental challenges, but there's also additional challenges on that from the stress of being in this neonatal intensive care. So there's a lot of study going on about how you can kind of try to get at some of that stress, which has really big impacts on long-term developmental outcomes and psychosocial outcomes and all sorts of things. And so, you know, we've known for some time that skin-to-skin contact is really important between new parents and babies. So it relaxes both the baby and the parent, regulates breathing and heart rate and all that sort of stuff. And one of my kids was born in Canada, and I can clearly remember the nurse in the hospital in the delivery room saying, right, get your shirt off, baby's going on your chest while mum's getting sorted out.
Aww,
and it was quite a weird thing to be in that environment with my shirt off, but it, you know, there's really good evidence that it works.
Mm.
Anyway, so you know, back to pain, there's a lot of interest in trying to find ways to alleviate pain in preterm bubs that aren't pharmacological. There are pharmacological interventions, but they have side effects and they're, you know, difficult to use on very, very small babies. And so people have been looking at lots of different ways. And one of the things that comes with attachment isn't just physical attachment, but it's sound. You know, we know babies respond to sound in the womb and they're used to the sound of their mother's voice and environment. And so this is a study that's come along from University of Geneva this week. It's only a small study. They only looked at 20 preterm bubs, but they looked at the way mum's voice might affect their response to pain. So they looked at babies while they were having a little blood prick taken off their foot to collect some blood. And then they did a switch experiment where they, you know, because these babies are constantly having lots of blood tests, on one occasion they had the sound where mum was just speaking to the child, another one where mum was singing like a lullaby or something to the child, and then another one where mum wasn't present. And they took videos of those, and then they asked independent observers who couldn't hear the sound to use a sort of well-established scale of looking at the facial expressions of the child, heartbeat, oxygen levels and various things to use come up with a graded pain scale. And they basically found that when the little preterm bubs could hear mum's voice, their pain experience dropped from something like 4.5 to 3 on the scale. So there was a significant reduction in the pain that was being experienced by these little kids.
Mm.
And what was really interesting is that that pain reduction wasn't as significant when mum was singing. It was mostly when she was talking.
Isn't that interesting?
And, it is. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and that's because they can hear the voice in the womb, so it's comforting to what they've heard before. Yeah,
that's right. And one of the clues, and, you know, there's a difference in the structure of speech and singing, for example, but the other thing that's really interesting is that at the same time they could see levels of the hormone oxytocin going up in the saliva of these little babies. And we know that oxytocin is one of those hormones that is related to attachment and maternal sensitivity and things like that. So they think that might be part of what's going on here to help protect these little bubs against the pain that they're feeling.
Yeah, beautiful. You know, that's the thing that talking to your babies, we know, is good for them, but that's something. And they can use that maybe with babies, because it's terrible to think they have to go through all these things when they're newly out and they're not quite ready for the world, and then they have to go through all that.
Yeah, it's really rough. And it's important for the parents too. You know, the parents suffer a huge amount of anxiety being separated from their little preterm bub. Yeah. So there's benefits to both here from having this effect. And they're now looking to see what the effect of dad's voice is as well, which is just as important in this context.
Might be just as powerful.
Be interesting to see what the results of that
one
is.
Won't it? Dr. Darren Saunders is with us. He's a cancer biologist and adjunct professor of science at Sydney University. Actually, it was interesting because, you know, Danielle, who worked on this show and had a baby, she went to get vaccinated a month or so ago, and it was the first time that her little baby had seen another baby.
Wow.
Born in lockdown, right?
Yeah,
just before lockdown. Well, he was smitten because it was a mother's vaccination day. So it was the first time he'd seen another little baby. Oh,
that's so cute. It's the things you don't think about.
The things you don't think about, because little babies haven't been meeting each other.
And we're social animals, you know. We're built to exist in social environments like that.
You should have seen him flirting like you wouldn't.
Oh, I can imagine. That's gorgeous.
She sent us a little video and I did laugh. All right, let's look at you know, the brain and hunger and interesting clues they've got on this, because of a woman who had a stroke. Tell us this story, Darren.
Yeah, I can't resist case studies. I think it goes along with studying biomedicine. You know, we learn a lot, particularly about brain function, from when bits of the brain get damaged. And that can be from a traumatic injury. It can be from something like a stroke, which we're looking at here. Or it can be from surgery or tumours and things like that. And in this case, it's a young woman, 28-year-old woman in Canada, who was hospitalised. She was feeling weak on one side of her body, having trouble speaking. You know, classic presentation of a stroke, even in a young person. So they imaged her brain and they found that she had in fact had a stroke. And what was interesting is that the stroke was in a part of her brain called the insular cortex, which is kind of buried. You know, the cortex is that big folded bit, the wrinkly bit on the outside of our brain. And the insular cortex is buried right down deep inside that, right at the bottom of one of those big folds, if you like. And it's a part of the brain that's involved in a thing called interoception. So it's things like consciousness, understanding emotion, compassion, empathy, motor control, self-awareness. It's one of those bits of the brain that seems to link lots of other bits of the brain together, and sort of an awareness of homeostasis. So homeostasis is that amazing physiological mechanism we have that keeps us alive, you know, to make sure we eat when we're hungry, and to regulate our temperature and all the other things that need
drink
to happen.
Drink when we're thirsty, that sort of
all
thing.
All of those things. Yep. Yeah, okay. All of those things. Interestingly, this part of the brain's also been looked at potentially in addiction. But what was really interesting is that this woman, soon after she'd been diagnosed with the stroke, she started noticing a strange aftertaste. So she could taste iron. And you might recognise that taste if you've ever had a blood nose, or sometimes people get that taste from different things.
Yeah.
So she started to have a different sensation of taste. But the really strange thing was that she never felt hungry anymore. Even if she hadn't eaten for a really long time, she had literally lost her sense of hunger. So she could still taste the food. She could still smell the food and the texture of the food and all that sort of stuff. But because she'd lost that drive to eat, she was only eating about half as much food as she normally would have. So even things like chocolate gave her no pleasure to eat anymore. It was kind of like eating for function.
Terrible.
Yeah, like a horrible thing. Like, you think about how much pleasure food gives most people. Not everybody, but most people. So she forgot to eat. She literally lost like 10 kilograms in a very short space of time because she had no sort of drive to go and get food and eat it. Now, interestingly, it came back. So she recovered her sense of hunger after about 15 months. But what this does is give us, because of where the stroke was in such a small localized part of her brain, it gives us another clue into how hunger is controlled, right? And we know lots about the various things that control hunger. There's lots of hormones and lots of different organs contribute, but this is just another piece of that puzzle.
Right. So does this show that it may be what sends the hunger mechanism from the brain to, I don't know, where do you feel hunger? Your stomach, your mouth?
Well, you feel it in all sorts of places, don't you? That's exactly right. So, yeah, it seems like this, maybe this part of the brain, the insular cortex, might be part of what's coordinating all of that. We know the hypothalamus, which is not far away from the insular cortex. The hypothalamus is a really important coordinating center. It sort of coordinates all the hormonal signals. You know, we also know that people who've had this part of their brain removed through sort of epilepsy surgery and stuff can have reduced appetite as well. So it gives us another angle into understanding hunger. And of course, we know hunger is one important part of things like obesity and lots of other conditions.
Yeah.
So it gives us another potential way to look at different ways to modulate people's appetites and hunger.
What if you could get a drug that could actually, you know, target people that part of the brain?
Yeah, people have been looking at this part of the brain in addiction treatment and using brain stimulation, not necessarily with drugs, but with magnetic fields, for example. It might even be possible to use psychosocial techniques to help people understand how the signals are being coordinated through their body, so to help them understand when they're feeling full, for example. So,
fascinating.
Yeah, it's a really interesting little insight into the brain from a poor woman's horrible experience.
Yeah, the poor thing. Well, I'm glad she got it back, though. That's the main thing. So it did recover. Yeah. And that, you know, would that be part of the brain's plasticity, I suppose, after things such as stroke, that some things do come back?
That's right. Yeah, almost certainly part of the plasticity. And you know, geez, imagine not being able to enjoy chocolate anymore.
Oh, terrible.
Talk about things getting me through lockdown. Chocolate is one of those things.
Chocolate, cartoons and Ted Lasso.
And surfing.
Yes. You've got to swim for me, Darren. Remember that.
I will. I'll take you swimming tomorrow, Sarah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Some people are really missing different things, and that's the one for me. But anyway, the water's still cold, so I'm clinging to that.
It's freezing.
Is it? Good.
Yeah.
Good. Let's talk about blue tongue lizards. I love blue tongue lizards. They have a special place in, I think, Australian suburban life because they're creatures that used to live under rocks in our garden as we were growing up. And there's a really interesting bit of work done into how they are, I suppose, you know, resistant to red-bellied black snakes.
This is really, it's a really interesting look at the defense mechanisms between different animals against snakes, you know, and we all know about how, you know, Australia has all these incredibly venomous snakes, the family of especially elapid snakes, which are things like red-bellied black snakes and brown snakes and tiger snakes and taipans and all the nasty ones that kill lots of things. People for a long time have been looking at how these venoms of these snakes work against mammals, with the obvious implication that we're interested in how it affects us and our pet dogs and our, you know, farm animals and things like that. Yeah. But in nature, the blue-tongued lizards are one of the things that gets eaten by red-bellied black snakes, not the only thing. And there are other lizards like goannas and those big monitor lizards, other members of the monitor lizard family, which will actually eat things like red-bellied black snakes. And so it's sort of interesting to look at how the evolution of these venoms has occurred in places like Australia, where we have this amazing spectrum of really nasty, toxic, venomous animals. And these venoms in these snakes are really complex mixtures of chemicals. They do all sorts of nasty things, but, you know, they can be neurotoxic and they can be cytotoxic, which means they kill cells. But one of the ways they kill you, and one of the most rapid ways they kill you, is they induce really widespread blood clotting. So you get this disseminated blood clotting right throughout your body, which causes all your organs to start to fail. Really, really particularly unpleasant way to die. And they do that through an enzyme cascade. So they have an enzyme in the venom which activates our blood clotting mechanism. And it's very easy to test how this works. You can take a little drop of blood from the animal you want to test it against. You add a little bit of venom and you can see the blood clotting in the test tube in front of you, or in little trays that they do it in. And you can measure how long it takes to clot. And that's an example of how long, or clotting time is an example of how sensitive the animal's blood is
to the venom,
right? Mm. And so these guys up in University of Queensland have been testing all these different venoms against different lizards, and they tested it against the blue tongue lizard, and they found that the venom had almost no effect on the blue tongue lizard blood. It didn't cause it to coagulate. Mm. the blue tongue lizard was susceptible to almost all of the other snakes that they tested, but not the red-bellied black snake.
So they must have co-evolved in areas where there was red-bellied black snakes.
That's right. So it looks like they've evolved some sort of defense mechanism. They haven't identified what it is yet. There's something in the blood that's different in a blue tongue lizard that makes it essentially doesn't respond to the venom of a red-bellied black snake. It's got a chemical defense mechanism of some sort. Things like the goannas, which will eat a red-bellied black snake, their blood was susceptible to it, but they have other forms of defense. So they have great big heavy sort of scales on their body that would protect them from a snake bite, and they're also more adept at handling a snake because they eat them, so they're used to dealing with them.
Yeah, I bet they are.
So it's a really interesting example of, of that co-evolution where we see, prey and predator evolving together. It's a very interesting
evolutionary
arms race.
And could it help us come up with an anti-venom?
Right. So that's one of the reasons we're interested in this, is by understanding there's all these chemicals in venom can be really useful. So, for example, we were just talking about people who've had strokes. There have been drugs developed based on snake venom, based on compounds in snake venom that will dissolve clots, for example, which cause strokes. So we've already got examples of that happening. There's a whole lot of stuff going on looking at their ability to potentially be painkillers and things like that. Mm-hmm. So by looking at the mechanism and how the blue tongue lizard's blood has evolved to be immune, if you like. Well, immune's not the right word. It's probably not the immune system, but doesn't get affected
resistant,
by the snake venom. Resistant, thank you. We could learn some really interesting chemistry that might have much broader applications for the rest of us.
Yes, so observing natural world can teach us a lot for science.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do like in the story, this is written up in the Herald this week, in the Sydney Morning Herald, and I do like they ask the scientist involved, what do you think the applications of this are? He goes, I don't really know. It's just a really cool experiment we've done, and it's a really cool insight into nature. And it's a nice reminder that it is worth doing science just to understand nature sometimes, not necessarily because we will gain something out of it as humans, even though we almost certainly will at some point.
Yes, good point, Darren. Good point. All right, well, here's another interesting story about nature, and it's about hummingbirds, because girl hummingbirds get a lot of, bad behaviour by the boys.
They get hassled.
Yes, a lot.
They get really hassled. Yeah, they get harassed, I would say, actually.
Totally.
Physically and mentally. So we're talking here about these little things called white-necked Jacobin hummingbirds. So they live in North and Central America and South America. And there's a lot of interest in birds, particularly in the way they're coloured. And, almost everybody knows the story that usually in the bird world, it's the males that have all the beautiful plumage. And the females tend to be somewhat duller. And we think, for a long time, the explanation for that has been a thing called sexual selection. So basically, we think that male birds have evolved things like, peacock's tails and all that sort of stuff as a way of attracting a mate. That's what it's thought to be. So every now and then, when a bird species comes along like these hummingbirds, where suddenly we discover that a whole lot of females have really bright plumage as well, it gets people really interested because it gets to one of these key theories about how evolution actually works. And in these little hummingbirds, this study that's come out this week has found that a significant proportion of these hummingbirds, the females actually mimic the colour of the males. And when they do that, it stops them getting harassed by the males. So normally the females will get chased around and, they're trying to get nectar and all this sort of stuff. The males basically don't do anything in this species. They don't help build the nest. They don't help rear the chicks. They basically, their
just
job is a
pretty.
Very short one. They look pretty, attract a mate, their job's done, move on. Exactly. Exactly.
Right. So if the girls dress like the boys leave them alone.
The boys leave them alone. And so what that does is punch a pretty big hole in the idea of sexual selection being the thing that's driving this colouring. And it gets to another theory that's out there that's possibly a little bit less well sort of accepted, which is one of social selection. So then you look at the whole community of the animal and look at the things that might be driving the selection of various traits in that way. So from a high-level evolutionary theory perspective, this is a really interesting insight. But it's also a really cool story about the way birds have evolved to avoid harassment in the bird world.
Right.
But
do they still mate with these girls that look like boys, I suppose? Because if they didn't, that wouldn't pass that on and it wouldn't keep existing.
The males don't have a preference. So the normal females are a greenish kind of colour.
Yeah.
The males are like a bright blue kind of colour.
Mm.
The males had a clear preference for the green females. They're not as attracted to the blue females. So right. It can't be the evolution of that blue colour by the females hasn't evolved to attract a mate, because it doesn't attract a mate. In fact, it has the opposite effect. But what it does is allow them more time to feed, for example, because they're not getting harassed by the males chasing a mate.
Yes.
And so it might be that that's one of the things that's driven this evolution of colour, is that it's got nothing to do with mate selection. In fact, it's all to do with their ability to get energy. You know, hummingbirds use huge amounts of energy.
But if they're going to pass that on, they've got to have chicks.
That's right. Exactly. And so one of the things they've observed is that this seems to happen in the juvenile birds more than the adult females. So it's much more frequent in the younger females, and as they get older and older and start to mature, quite a lot of them lose that colouring and start to become the other colour.
Oh, so well, that's good. Then they don't get hassled when they're young girls.
Exactly. Oh. So when they're sort of teenage birds, they're getting left alone. And then, it's a really interesting look into how harassment works in the bird world.
Isn't it? Is there a lesson there for dressed blokes?
There might have been a reason I picked that study today.
Well, Claire has sent me a lovely photo of a blue-tongued lizard from ACT, where she lives in Weston.
I love blue-tongued lizards. They're so wonderful. Cool. I used to catch them when I was a kid, or not catch them to keep, but just to go chasing them. They're beautiful things.
They do bite, though. Yeah, they do. That's right. I remember one bit my sister when she was mucking around with it one day. Yeah, we had one that lived under some stone stairs at our house. I haven't seen one my house now, though, for a long time.
There's a few at my mum and dad's house, and the males fight horribly at this time of year. When they're you know, looking for partners and fighting over territory and stuff, they really hook into each other and, like, you know, take big chunks out of each other.
Oh, nice.
Quite vicious.
Okay.
Yeah, quite vicious.
Well, if there's another sign of spring then. The blue-tongued lizard boys are fighting.
I got my first magpie attack today.
Did you?
I did.
Are you
came
all
out
right?
of the sun, didn't see it coming, rolled my ankle on the deck.
Oh, wow.
I love magpies. I absolutely love them.
Even though you've been attacked, you still love them.
You've got to love something that small that's brave.
Tis the season. So, put your hands up in the air and wave them around, because you do care. Good luck. Thanks, Darren.
Thanks, Sarah. Talk to you soon.
Hope your ankle's all right. There's Dr. Darren Saunders. He's a cancer biologist and adjunct professor of biology at the University of Sydney.
You're with Sarah McDonald on Evenings.